how to mourn as a society. George Floyd's story is inseparable from his tragic death, and any commemoration should not shy away from the fact. So one possibility would be to make 25th of May, the day that George Floyd was murdered, a day of both public commemoration and public reflection. It could help highlight the ongoing dysfunctions of American democracy while creating opportunities for public dialogue and public work. It could be a day of protest and service. In light of America's tragic history and its continuing challenges of violence, disrespect, and unequal access to liberty, 25th of May could become a day of public mourning, understood as a space for sharing not just grief about the present world, but also aspirations for a world that Americans could build together. A day of mourning would open up potential spaces in American politics, even if momentarily, and recapture some of the dreamlike quality of that brief time when, after George Floyd's murder, another world seemed possible.
Around the World with Reporters.
A ceasefire took hold on Friday in the Gaza Strip as Israel and Hamas agreed to halt nearly 2 weeks of fighting that left hundreds dead and parts of the impoverished Gaza Strip destroyed. There were no reports of violations early Friday, though each side said it stood ready to retaliate for any attacks by the other.
After the ceasefire, I am sending words of thanks and appreciation for the Palestinian resistance and for the countries who supported Palestinians with both money and weapons, especially the Islamic Republic of Iran that offered everything and stood with Palestinians to a great extent.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took to the streets and held celebrations of their victory, embracing one another in front of bombed buildings. Palestinians in Gaza could not mark Eid al-Fitr festival at Ramadan conclusion due to the Israeli airstrikes. On Friday, postponed Eid celebrations were held throughout Gaza.
This is a celebration of our victory. We celebrate winning and teaching the inhumane Israeli regime a lesson that we won't remain silent over its crimes, even if it costs us everything, even our children and homes. This is the road of our resistance till Palestine is free.
We spent days of Ramadan waiting for aid, and then this escalation started, but we all supported Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. Gazans did all of this to support Palestinians in Jerusalem. We didn't count on any other country. We supported each other and defended Al-Aqsa.
More than 10 days of attacks killed at least 240 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children, wounded more than 1,900, and damaged critical infrastructure and thousands of homes, according to officials. The clashes began when the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started its eviction plans of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem.
We are all here now in high spirits. We have witnessed three wars, and today Gaza didn't give up defending Palestinians. We are glad of this victory, and we appreciate the efforts of our resistance that did everything to support us and defend our rights.
After days of Israeli strikes, people are here celebrating their victory, stressing to support the Palestinian resistance in the face of the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
In Lebanon, support for Palestine has overcome even internal crises, with more people rallying to show support. The Palestinian resistance Hamas representative in Lebanon told Press TV Palestinian resistance has the advanced capabilities to deter the Israeli aggression for an unrestricted period of time.
We have reached a new phase in the conflict with the Zionist enemy, since the enemy is in a state of crisis, facing the blows of the resistance. The resistance in Palestine is part of the entire resistance front. The enemy has realized that if it launches an assault on any group, the entire front will come forward to give a due response. For now, the Palestinian resistance has declared that it has the capabilities to face this occupation for a long period of time with hundreds or even thousands of rockets.
A Hezbollah member of parliament at the rally said it is an Islamic duty for all Muslims, as it is for Palestinians, to liberate Palestine.
The Palestinian cause is not only for Arabs, it's also for all Muslims. When a nation is involved in a conflict, all other nations step into the fray to stand against a joint enemy. Our slogan is that Al-Quds victory is closer today more than ever.
Despite the heinous Israeli crimes, Palestinian people's intense uprising and resistance remain unabated. Observers believe that that in itself will weaken the Israeli army.
We cannot describe with words the heroic endeavor of the Palestinian people. We can only salute the great Palestinians and their martyrs. We also salute all those who have stood with them in the most difficult circumstances. A salute to the Islamic Republic of Iran, since it weren't for Iran, the entire region would have a different fate. The 2006 war in Lebanon destroyed the first pillar of the occupation regime, and today in Palestine, the second pillar has already fallen.
Hundreds of Lebanese and Palestinians are holding protests on a daily basis across the country to show that they are ready to give more direct assistance to Palestine if need be.
We are ready to put all our efforts in assisting the oppressed people in Palestine, and that is our duty to give that assistance for the sake of righteousness against our unjust enemy.
The Palestinian-Israeli conflict has always been inseparable from the Lebanese-Israeli conflict. Today, even Lebanese activists in solidarity with Palestine's uprising in the face of Israeli aggression say the Lebanese resistance should give direct backing to the Palestinian resistance whenever there is a need, anytime in the future. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A fourth round of talks to revive the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, concludes in Vienna, with delegations headed back home for further consultations. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there'd been substantial progress in the past 10 days, but there were still issues that needed to be worked on. Mora said he believed an agreement was possible before Iran's presidential elections next month.
I will not venture a date because you never know, but I'm quite sure that there will be a final agreement, yeah, not far from here.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the issues that needed resolution were difficult.
Some delegations believe that the next round could be the last round. I cannot say that indefinitely, but because we are not there, we are still not there. But I think that if the other side, especially the U.S. side, can make their difficult decisions, we might be able to come to the conclusion next time we meet here in Vienna.
Araghchi said Iran is standing firm on its position that the U.S. needs to fully lift all sanctions in a verifiable manner before Tehran can take action to come back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Reports indicate that though the U.S. has agreed to ease sanctions on various sectors like energy, banking, shipping and insurance, there are still differences on sanctioned individuals and entities, including Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. Questions have also been lingering on the fate of Iran's advanced centrifuges and whether the U.S. sanctions will be fully removed or temporarily eased. The sides have decided to meet again next week. Homa Lizgi, Vienna.
The
These protesters have staged a sit-in in Imam Hussein Square of Tehran to show anger at the brutalities of the Israeli regime in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
This year, due to the corona pandemic, we couldn't stage rallies on Quds International Day. So today we are here to support Palestinians and condemn the atrocities of the Zionist regime against them.
Whenever a crime happens in the world, the international bodies release statements and slam it. But they are silent about the brutal acts of Israel in Gaza. I'm here to show solidarity with Palestinians and tell them that they are not alone.
It is our duty to participate in such events. Since the Islamic Revolution, we have participated in all these demonstrations, and right now we are here to support the innocent women and children of Gaza and Palestine.
Waving the flags of Palestine and the resistance movement, they chanted slogans against the global arrogance and the Israeli regime, which has recently begun a new wave of attacks on the besieged Gaza. In their slogans, the demonstrators also announced that they stand with Palestinians and their cause until they achieve victory. The IRGC commander was the speaker of the event, who blasted Israel, saying that this time the situation has changed.
This is the first time that Israel's shipping and aviation industries are disrupted. This is the first time that Israel's capital is being showered by missiles every day. This is the first time that all Zionists are in shelters.
At the end of this gathering, a statement was also read out to wrap up the demands of the Iranians from the international bodies regarding the crimes committed by Israel.
Over 200 people, including women and children, have been killed in recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, while millions of people across the world have taken to the streets to condemn the Israeli aggression. The international bodies are still keeping quiet. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Palestinians have staged a nationwide general strike across the occupied West Bank and in historic Palestine, the lands occupied in 1948, to protest the ongoing Israeli bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. The strike has led to the suspension of all economic activities and the closure of educational institutions across the occupied West Bank. Shops and private institutions in Palestinian areas in historic Palestine also closed down. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in Ramallah to support the strike.
We won't tolerate the continuation of the occupation. It must end. The Israeli regime carries out the ugliest practices against our people, wherever they are. And then there are the settlers' ongoing violence. And now there are these airstrikes that are killing children and innocent people.
Protesters from all walks of life and of all ages participated in the rally that headed to the northern entrance of the city, where Israeli military checkpoint and illegal settlement of Beit El are located. The protesters held Palestinian flag and chanted anti-Israeli slogans in solidarity with the resistance in the Gaza Strip.
Today, we are rising against Israel's airstrikes on the Gaza Strip and its general operation against Palestinians here in the West Bank.
We are protesting against the ongoing violence against us, the Palestinians, and also to show support for the resistance in Gaza.
The rally, meanwhile, turned violent, with the Israeli soldiers at the checkpoint firing live ammunition. Palestinians in the occupied territories and historic Palestine have united with a general strike and a day of rage to send in numerous messages. On the top, an expression of anger against this barbaric aggression by the Israeli occupation. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
It was billed as an emergency meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers to discuss the deadly violence in the Middle East. In fact, critics of Israel call it an illegal and merciless bombardment of Palestinians rather than a conflict. The ministers couldn't decide on anything concrete, and so the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, ended up playing the event down.
In an informal meeting, there is no formal conclusions. And what I am going to explain you is my takeaway, my intellectual takeaway from the today meeting.
That takeaway basically consisted of merely calling for peace and for Israel's actions to be proportionate. Rights groups insist what's needed instead is for the EU to slap sanctions on Tel Aviv.
EU, especially if they are true and faithful to their own commitment for human rights protection, there is a time that they have to reflect on these issues. And I think also the pressure coming from civil society is playing a very important role.
But as Palestinians continue to suffer, perhaps Israel's influence in the West is too strong. The White House says the U.S. will continue to provide $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel each year, claiming the regime has a right to defend itself.
The United States cannot continue to act alone and try to impose on all of us, including the European Union, their ideas. They have to engage everyone as we engage in the United Nations.
A large number of EU lawmakers have issued statements condemning Israel's actions. Some of these statements have been strongly worded.
They insist Israel is guilty of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The MEPs are calling on the EU to suspend its substantial trade with Israel until such time as Tel Aviv stops breaking international laws.
EU legislators are due to hold a number of debates on the crisis this week. The big question is, what difference will they make when it comes to the powers that be? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has concluded his visit to Italy, where he held consultations on the enhancement of mutual cooperation and bilateral ties. On Monday, Iran's top diplomat met with his Italian counterpart, Luigi Di Maio, with whom he talked about political, economic and cultural aspects in view of the historical relations between Iran and Italy. This year marks the 160th anniversary of formal diplomatic relations between the two countries. Issues related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the ongoing nuclear talks were also on the table.
Italy's position with regard to the nuclear deal is that of waiting to see what might happen. Rome doesn't have an autonomous policy of its own on a number of crucial international issues and is waiting for the US to make a move.
The talks between the two ministers revolved around Italy's posture on the nuclear deal. Years ago, under a Berlusconi government, Rome had the opportunity to play a leading role in the build-up process of the deal, but the role went to Germany in the end. Today, Tehran is assessing whether Italy aims to play a greater role in the revival of the JCPOA.
Also on Monday, Zarif met with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, who presented him with a gift that, the pontiff said, was a symbol of peace with an olive branch and a dove. The Vatican provided no comment on the content of the talks.
During his trip to Europe, the Iranian foreign minister was expected to visit Austria, where Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are holding talks to find a way to revive the international accord. But the visit was cancelled after Vienna's decision to show solidarity with Israel by flying the regime's flag over government office buildings.
Italy has been quite careless on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis over the past years. Rome once held a position of equal closeness with the parts involved in the conflict, not one of equidistance like it is now. Italy was once very attentive to the needs of the Palestinians, whilst today its stance doesn't help finding a solution to the crisis, for which Israel bears grave responsibilities.
On Tuesday, on his final day in Rome, Zarif met with a delegation of lawmakers from the Italian parliament at the Iranian ambassador's residence, Max Civili, Rome.
Free at last. Emerging from the gloom of a four-month COVID-19 lockdown, most Britons are now free to hug, albeit cautiously, visit their pub, sit down to an indoor meal, or visit the cinema. Freedom beckons once more. There is excitement.
I'm happy that I could go to the movies again, you know, because it's just been like you're running out of things to do.
We've just had a lovely lunch, first time in all those months inside a restaurant. It felt good.
But beside the euphoria, there is also anxiety, the emergence of the Indian variant of COVID-19.
I'm told that if it's only marginally more transmissible, we can continue more or less as planned. But if the variant is significantly more transmissible, we're likely to face some hard choices. Thank you very much.
Perhaps the toughest of those choices, another lockdown. Some scientists, among them the government's chief medical officer, have warned of a summer surge in cases.
All the modelling suggests there is going to be a further surge, and that will find the people who either have not been vaccinated or where the vaccine's not worked.
So far, nearly 70% of Britons over the age of 18 have been offered their first dose of the vaccine, with the government saying the country is in a race between the vaccination program and the virus, especially the new variant first found in India that's been surging in several areas across England.
So will there be another lockdown? Boris Johnson has called the lockdown roadmap cautious but irreversible. Last month, he came under fire for allegedly saying, let the bodies pile on high in their thousands, after reluctantly approving a second England-wide lockdown late last year.
It'd be obviously disappointing, but I would say not entirely unexpected, to be honest.
Steps need to be taken to deal with it. And if that means additional vaccination surges in areas where it exists, or local lockdowns, or nationwide, or travel restrictions, then my belief is that those should be brought in.
The UK's official death toll is nearly 128,000, Europe's highest figure and the world's fifth largest, after the United States, Brazil, India, and Mexico. And the possible outbreak of the Indian variant is sure to upset the Johnson government's roadmap out of lockdown. Saeed Puriza, London.
The families of the victims of the recent deadly attack near a school in Kabul call for proper attention to be paid to those affected by the incident. The families put the casualties at 90 deaths and over 240 wounded, all students. They also called on the international community, the UN and human rights bodies to probe the brutal attack. Referring to repeated targeting of Shia people by terrorist groups in Afghanistan, they also urged the international bodies to officially confirm the systematic genocide of Shia people in the country.
The attack on Sayyid al-Shuhada school came after a series of targeted attacks on Shia religious sites, educational centers, and sports clubs. It's a genocide, and we want the government and international bodies to officially confirm Shia genocide in Afghanistan.
But as observers say, it seems that neither terrorist attacks nor political obstacles can push back the determined young generation of Afghanistan, as they are fully committed to go forward in order to build their own country by relying on knowledge instead of war and violence.
The government has not yet fulfilled its obligation to protect us. The recent attack on innocent schoolgirls was a big tragedy, and such incidents must be stopped in the future. The enemy must know that we will go forward despite the challenges.
It was in the afternoon of May 8 when three back-to-back blasts rocked western Kabul, and many fasting residents of the area witnessed how dozens of schoolgirls were hit by these blasts. Although the Taliban has denied any involvement in the attack, but none of other terrorist groups, including Daesh, has claimed responsibility too.
Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has emphasized on the need for a practical step from the government. President Ghani has already ordered a thorough probe into the attack and has called on his government to work on a plan to boost the security in Kabul. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
the limelight.
According to a United Nations World Food Programme WF report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Robin Scher, writer. This article is published under the heading, Pandemic May Have Left 265 Million People with Acute Food Shortages in 2020. Here's more. According to a United Nations World Food Programme report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. The combined effect of the pandemic as well as the emerging global recession could, without large-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and a scale unseen for more than half a century, states another UN report. In the United States, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children due to the pandemic, states a June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research, IPR, at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. In a recent interview with CBS News, IPR Director Dionne Whitmore warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Latino families. Indeed, families of color are being disproportionately impacted. According to an analysis of new census data by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, 22% of Black and 21% of Latino respondents reported not having enough to eat, compared to just 9% with white people. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, WFP Director David Beasley told the UN Security Council in April 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. He added, "In a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about 36 countries. And in fact, in 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation." The number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about 8 times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date, wrote Mark Lowcock, the Under Secretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and Alex Van Trottenberg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank. Countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stunt whole generations. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminished food safety. The same might be said about the pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures
that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children and young people have been affected. Schools provide a food lifeline for children. For so many, that is where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, UNICEF and WFP released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in school meals have been missed worldwide since the pandemic began, with 370 million children worldwide having missed 40% of in-school meals. In early 2020, when COVID-19 was still a looming specter rather than the deadly virus we are more familiar with today, the threat of food insecurity was a practical problem. Scenes of shoppers descending on aisles to stock up on supplies was a common sight. As CNN reported in March 2020, supermarkets around the world rationed food and other products such as toilet paper and cleaning supplies in an effort to curb stockpiling. In Vermont, for instance, a steady increase in food insecurity since the start of the pandemic has correlated to employment levels, according to a survey conducted by the University of Vermont between March and April 2020. Approximately 45% of respondents had either lost their jobs, been furloughed, or had their hours reduced during the pandemic. And a further two-thirds of survey participants who recorded scarcity of food in their households had experienced job losses or work disruptions since the outbreak of the pandemic, according to the survey. Vermont is just one example. The impact has been felt across the U.S. during the week before Thanksgiving last year. The Guardian reported that 5.6 million U.S. households struggled to put enough food on the table, while referring to the analysis of the census data by CVPP. As the pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain. With factory and supermarket workers being highly susceptible to COVID-19, there has been a commitment decline in food production and a rise in prices. As Scott Faber, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at Environmental Working Group, EWG, reported, farmers across the U.S. were already facing labor shortages prior to the pandemic. And with tightened immigration as well as the heightened risk and poor compensation associated with these jobs, food processors and farm labor contractors may struggle to find other workers willing to risk their lives to work in meat plants, packing sheds, or produce fields. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. The monstrous and unsustainable food industry known as Big Ag relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch, can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressure during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America. April M. Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote in Salon, "Among the many necessary systematic changes, 2020 has illuminated the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities. It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of the food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, while nearly 690 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the pandemic has underscored matter According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million due to COVID-19, representing an 82% increase compared to the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19. And the disruption of transportation has shown that the long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. Food banks are under tremendous pressure to meet the skyrocketing demand, wrote Claire Bainbow Fonaut, Feeding America CEO, and Zippy Duval, president of the American Farm Bureau, to then Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue in April of last year. At the same time, however, we are seeing literally tons of agricultural goods being discarded because of the shutdown of so much of the economy. Consumer demand has shifted from eating out at restaurants and food services away from home, and food supply chain operations have had to be retooled. And that impact has been felt within the transportation sector. Forbes reported that Andrew Novowick, an agricultural economist at Cornell University, points to a number of weak spots in the food transportation system that could be aggravated by the increased demand for food. A shortage of truck drivers is one potential weak spot, says Novavik. Although he concedes there is debate on this matter, he maintains that trucking companies are finding it much harder to recruit those long-haul drivers. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June 2020. While the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed, the OECD report states. The biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity. Another problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era. As The Economist recently pointed out, journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision contest, but only around 2,000 about drought and hunger in Zambia.
Africa Today.
Protests and demonstrations have continued to rock Chad following a military takeover after veteran ruler Idriss Deby Itno died fighting rebels. Many have taken to the streets of the capital in N'Djamena, rejecting the installation of Mahamat Idriss Deby, the son of the late president, as the head of the transitional authority. Now, the masses want the military to step down in favor of a civilian leadership.
We're in a country where human dignity is flouted and we have had enough. We have suffered a lot and now it's enough. We want the military power to leave and to let us choose our leaders freely. We are not puppets. We are tired.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, which will focus on the unfolding crisis in Chad, where the governing military council is cracking down on angry protesters who are defying a ban to demonstrate against the junta that took over power in violation of Chad's constitution. Now, in the second segment of our show, we shall talk about the renewed push to return the famous Benin bronzes looted by Britain during its colonial rule in Nigeria. But why are Nigerians demanding the return of these sculptures? A Nigerian curator here explains.
Edo people, it's important for Nigerians, it's important for Africans, because it's a huge testimony of our history, of our culture, and of the exquisite craftsmanship that produced these masterpieces.
Join us for more till the end of our show and send us your views and opinion as you watch.
Trouble in Chad. The newly re-elected president of Chad, Idriss Deby, died of wounds he suffered on the front line while commanding his army in battles against rebels in the north last April. The shock news of Deby's death came only the day after the 68-year-old career military man was proclaimed the winner of a presidential election that had given him a sixth term in office. In the aftermath of the death of Idriss Deby, who ruled with an iron fist for three decades, his 37-year-old son, Mohamed Deby, was installed as chairman of the Transitional Military Council of Chad. The military takeover has triggered protests, with Chadians insisting that the country is not a monarchy and that the constitution should be followed. Several people have been killed by security forces during protests. A resident of Jemena explains here why they came out to protest.
They talk about democracy in theory, but on the ground there's no democracy. That's why people came out today, to protest and demand their rights, because we're fed up.
Now, in a bid to prevent the situation from escalating out of control, the chairman of the Military Council of Chad, Mohamed Deby, has called for dialogue.
Ces valeurs si chères à notre défunt président seront éprouvées.
These values, so dear to our late president, will be demonstrated and enshrined in the framework of an inclusive national dialogue that will be organized during this transition period. I will be the guarantor of this dialogue, which will not shy away from any subject of national interest, according to a precise timetable that the government will be called upon to reveal.
Now, former colonial power France has come under sharp criticism for backing the illegal military takeover in Chad for its own vested interests in this North Central African nation. Now, for an incisive analysis on the situation in Chad, we are joined by Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy and history. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, what is the current situation in Chad after the killing of Deby and the appointment of his son as the interim president?
It's very tense because there's opposition to the establishment of a transitional military council. The president of the National Assembly was slated to take power in the country in the event of the assassination or the incapacitation of the president. That did not happen. And it's still not clear exactly under what circumstances President Idriss Deby Itno was killed. The government said he sustained injuries while on the front line against the FACT rebels, yet no specific information has been released to the international press.
Thanks for that, Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire.
37-year-old Mohamed Idriss Deby, a four-star general, is in charge of the Transitional Military Council, which was formed after his father's death. He is therefore acting as the de facto interim president of Chad for a period of 18 months. According to Chad's constitution, which was suspended by the military, the Speaker of the Parliament must take over when a sitting president dies before elections can be held. Leading opposition parties in Chad have rejected the military takeover.
Voici la déclaration officielle du Haut Commandement.
Chad is not a monarchy. There can be no dynastic devolution of power in our country.
Now, under Chadian law, the Speaker of Parliament should have taken power after Deby's death and not his son. Now, why did the army refuse to obey the constitution?
There is concern about the overall stability inside the country. Chad has been a bulwark of France and the United States in their efforts, so-called counterterrorism campaigns in Central and West Africa. There was some trepidation in regard to moving forward with the same political dispensation. The son of the president, 37-year-old Mahatma Dibe Itno, was appointed as the chairperson of a transitional military council. Now, it appears to people on the outside of the country and many inside the country that this was a coup d'etat because they did not follow the constitutional protocols that were voted on by the Chadian people. So it's a very serious issue, and also internationally, the African Union wants some movement in regard to the current regime that is operating now in Chad.
Idris Deby, who came to power in a rebellion in 1990, was an important Western ally in Africa for three decades. He facilitated military intervention by France and the US in Africa. Following the death of this veteran ruler, White House offered sincere condolences while France said it had lost a brave friend. Now, to underscore the importance of Chad to France, Emmanuel Macron was among the foreign dignitaries who attended Idris Deby's funeral in N'Djamena. Now, Mr. Azikiwe, as you mentioned earlier, Idris Deby was a darling of Western powers, especially the United States and France. What are the interests of these imperialist powers in Chad?
Chad is a oil-producing state. It is also located on the border of a number of important countries, such as the Lake Chad Basin region, where Nigeria is located, and Cameroon, which are huge oil-producing states. Also, former President Dibe was willing to utilize his military forces as a conduit for AFRICOM, United States Africa Command, and also Operation Barkhane, which is a French military operation in West and Central Africa. And both these militaries are there to represent the interests of Washington, Wall Street, and Paris. They claim they're in the region to strengthen the security capabilities of the various African nations so they can fight against Islamic terrorism. But as many people already know, a lot of the groups that are said to be terrorists previously have been supported by the U.S.
Idris Deby died of his injuries following clashes with rebels belonging to a group calling itself FACT, or the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, in the northern part of the Central African country. Founded in 2016 by former army officers, the group, like opposition politicians and rights groups in Chad, accused Deby of repression in the run-up to the election. These rebels built up their base in Libya in the Tibesti Mountains, which straddle northern Chad and part of southern Libya. How powerful is the rebel group that killed President Deby?
They were previously based in neighboring Libya. They were allied with Khalifa Haftar, who is the head of the Libyan National Army. And of course, Haftar had been for many years, decades even, an asset of the United States Central Intelligence Agency. Since 2011, he was flown back to Libya during the counter-revolution against the previous Jemahiriya government under Colonel Gaddafi. When Gaddafi was overthrown and killed, Haftar made several bids to take control in Tripoli, all of which were unsuccessful. Now there's a new United Nations-appointed government of national unity in Tripoli, and it's interesting that this FACT rebel group left the country in the immediate aftermath of the establishment of this UN-appointed government.
Idris Deby established ties with the Israeli regime, which provided him with weapons to sustain his brutal grip on power. Chad is among several African countries utilizing deadly weapons acquired from the Israeli regime that are used for repression and other human rights violations.
Now, the Israeli regime fueled the conflict in Chad by supplying Idris Deby with weapons and thus enabled him to extend his dictatorship. Now, can you elaborate further on the role of the Israeli regime in destabilizing Chad?
Since 2016, there have been contacts between the State of Israel and the Debe administration. Foreign Ministry had visited Chad in 2016. In 2018, the late President Debe visited Israel. Israel has supplied intelligence assistance as well as weaponry to the Chadian military, which serves as a linchpin in terms of providing ground troops for all these military operations that are going on in Central and West Africa over the last several years. So Israel is very much involved because they want to, of course, be involved in Africa as well because of its strategic resources and also in an attempt to undermine the Palestinian struggle and the struggle in Syria.
Now, the aftershocks of the death of Idris Deby Itno on April 20 are only beginning to appear. The future of Chad remains fragile and uncertain. Instability in Chad is bound to have far-reaching repercussions across the Sahel region. Now, a resident here expresses fear of clashes between the military and rebels.
La guerre là, c'est pour détruire le pays.
War destroys the country. Now there are soldiers who confiscated power, and those guys over there are saying they are going to come. We don't agree. If they come, there must be a dialogue.
Now, Mr. Azikiwe, several people have been killed protesting against the military junta. Now, should we expect a turbulent and violent transition period?
It depends on the political and social balance of forces. It appears as if there's unease in the country among the working people, the youth, and farmers inside the country, and perhaps even elements within the military as well, that this new government was installed without any consultation or any participation from the existing political parties as well as the National Assembly.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe, for your insight. Now we shall take a short break. And when we come back, we shall talk about how Western countries are reluctant to return Benin bronzes looted during the British colonial period. Now, don't go away.
Looted Benin bronzes in the West.
In 1897, British colonial forces razed Benin City, massacring an unknown number of people and bringing a violent end to the Kingdom of Benin, which had thrived for centuries as one of West Africa's major powers. Now, during the raid, British troops looted at least 3,000 precious items made by the Edo people.
The looted items included ivory statues, craved elephant tusks, ceramics, masks, craved portraits of kings, and more than 1,000 intricately decorated brass plaques that once adorned ancestral altars and court buildings in the city's royal palace. Benin City, situated in modern-day southern Nigeria, was famed for its specialist bronze sculpting guilds, groups of skilled artisans that produced works of huge historic and cultural importance. The looted bronze statues have spread further and further afield over the years, popping up periodically across Europe and the United States. Now they're increasing calls for the return of these precious cultural heritage items.
We want
outright return of those things here. They belong here. This is where they were made, and we know the purpose, the reason why we made them.
Now, to discuss the return of these looted cultural heritage items belonging to the people of Benin in Nigeria, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot, Mr. Mbaluto, and it's great having you. Now, first, can you tell us how important are the Benin bronzes to the people of Nigeria and Africa, actually, in general?
Very, very important, because most of the artifacts or even sculptures represent the cultural mix, the cultural heritage of a country. And therefore, when we talk about all these bronzes, they represent the culture of Benin City, you know, everybody from that particular country where they were taken from. They also represent, like, the history, the heritage of the Kingdom of Benin. We are speaking right now of the British Museum has got about 900 pieces of that. Benin court has requested them to be taken back, but the negotiations are still ongoing. That's where we are with that.
Julius Mbaluto, the African Affairs Analyst.
Western art historians and museum professionals claim that various forms of danger in the West have historically posed just as much as of a threat to the Benin bronzes as a perceived lack of climatic control found at Nigerian museums.
Now, this is while Africans have been making their artifacts and preserving them for centuries before they were looted by European invaders. Now, some museum professionals claim Nigeria and Africa in general does not have the technical capacity to take care of its cultural heritage. What's your take?
African professionals are capable of doing anything that the Western countries can do, given the chance. And therefore, to say Nigerian professionals are not experts enough to keep is just an insult to adding an insult to injury. What they need to do is just take these artifacts back. They need to just take everything they took from these countries back, because this is part of this country's heritage.
Now, amid mounting calls for restitution, institutions like the British Museum, holder of the world's largest collection of Benin bronzes, have been forced to consider returning the stolen heritage items.
A new museum is being built in Benin City to facilitate this. But as it stands, most of the looted bronzes will only be returned on a temporary, not permanent basis. A resident of Benin City, like most of his compatriots, rejects the preposterous idea of loaning the bronzes instead of permanently returning them.
The question I may ask, is it their own property? Why should you loan my own property to me? You cannot loan my own property to me. You understand? They stole it quite well.
Why are most Western museums insisting on a temporary return of these looted heritage items instead of permanently returning them to where they rightly belong in Africa?
The countries that have all this, for example, like talk about if you came to London and say, oh, let all this go back to the countries that you came from, most of these museums will be left empty. You know, these museums in London, they make so much money from tourists who go to see all these things. And, you know, the key thing is that it's all about the money involved. And therefore, you find that definitely the wealth they are making, they don't want that to let that go. And that's why it's so difficult to get it done.
The people of Nigeria are eager to reconnect with their looted heritage, but it remains to be seen if museums in Western countries will stop their greed and return these looted items of African heritage.
The governor of Edo State, whose capital is Benin City, says talks are ongoing about returns that are expected to be a boost for a broader movement building across Africa and beyond, seeking colonial-era loot.
We would you know, be open to such conversations. So there's just not one track decision as to whether it's going to be a loan or a permanent return. You know, we will be open to having a broad range of discussions on each piece of work.
Mr. Mbaluto, last question to you. Now, will the return of these Benin bronzes have a domino effect that will see the eventual return of other African heritage artifacts looted by colonialists?
One of the fears that countries that looted all this wealth from Africa fear, if they say yes to one country, there will be a domino effect. Other countries whose wealth was looted, they will follow suit. And that has always been the greatest fear. How do I know? Probably. I covered the Mama Veterans case in courts in London, which they